The discussion this morning is entitled The Mask of Democracy, False Freedom, False Hope. And it really is going to be dealing with what's happening in the last year in Guatemala. But I wanted to open today, almost in light of yesterday's Chief Seattle Day, because I was reading this book coming up by I. Rigoberto Menchú. She is she and her father and whole family were leaders of the indigenous community. And I think in light of what we were thinking about yesterday and continue to think about, I find this fascinating. And it's a chapter she has on their concern for the earth. From very small children, we received an education which is very different from white children. Our parents tell us, children, the earth is the mother of humans because she gives us food. Our parents teach us to respect the earth. We must only harm the earth when we are in need. That is why, before we sow our mice, we have to ask the earth's permission. And then she goes into the ceremony they go before they cut into the ground at all, because they have a ceremony asking the earth's permission to cut into the ground and to sow the seeds. Later on she has, we say, Mother Earth, you who give us food, whose children we are and on whom we depend, please make this produce you give us flourish and make our children and our animals grow. Then we say the name of the heart of the sky, the sun, which is very appropriate this morning. Our grandfathers say we must ask the sun to shine on all its children, the trees, animals, water, humans. We ask it to shine also on our enemies. To the earth we say, we respect you and love you and ask that you love us as we love you. For the sun we say, heart of the sky, you are our father. We ask you to give your warmth and light to our animals, our mice, our beans, our plants, so that they may grow and our children may eat. Then there's a final section, which the sun, as the channel to the one God, receives the plea from his children that they should never violate the rights of all the other beings which surround them. This is how we renew our prayers, which says that we, the children of the one God, must respect the life of the trees, the birds, the animals around us. We say the names of the birds and animals, cows, horses, dogs, cats, all these, we mention all of them. We respect the life of every single one of them. We must respect the life, the purity, the sacredness, which is water. We must respect the one God, the heart of the sky, which is the sun. We must do no evil while the sun shines upon his children. This is a promise. Oh, this is the kind of a spirit that still exists. And this is the culture. These are the people that are being eliminated. Because there are minerals up in those mountains. There are coffee and sugar to be grown and money to be made. So it's an interesting clash.
How are they being eliminated?
This is what we were talking about yesterday. They are being eliminated by being massacred. 100,000 have been killed since the 70s and 80s, and 38,000 have been disappeared. Their villages have been destroyed, and it's primarily over land and money. And their beautiful respect for the land is similar to the Indians in our society. The famous book of the country is called Men of Corn, or Hombres de Maíz. Sown to be eaten, he says, this is about corn, sown to be eaten, it is the sacred sustenance of men who were made of mice. Sown to make money, it means famine for the men who were made of mice. So it's the clash between those who use the earth for sustenance and respect it, and those who use the earth to make money. And that clash is partly a racial clash, But since it's a class over who controls is going to make money off the land, it's also inevitable clash between, basically, between capitalism, which uses the resources of the earth as a way of making money, and the kind of indigenous culture which has a ceremony anytime it cuts into the earth to plant the crops. Yesterday we talked about the hidden war. Part of it's since 1954, they've had military dictatorships in Guatemala. The military expanded its influence over that period of time, so that it began to be, it's the major landowner. The generals and the military are the major landowners. They all own a number of the factories and the corporations. The major bank in Guatemala is owned by the bank. It's called the Bank of the Army. They have a slogan right on the side, "Where your money is secure." So the Bank of the Army is probably branches all over. And it's, so after 30 years, the military began to control the economy, certainly the government, the agriculture. And any attempts to question this control was put down. And of course, the wrath, those who questioned it most were the ones at the bottom whose land was being taken from them, the indigenous. Fernando Bermudez, a Catholic priest who is now in exile, it was his experience of this in the early 80s that he wrote about in Death and Resurrection in Guatemala, which is in the bookstore. So there was a reign of terror, massacres in the villages. Nicholas Gonzalez, who's in sanctuary with us, told us that about something there. I was reminded again when I saw the video yesterday, The Wrath of Grapes. Nicholas told us that about the mothers, they'd go with the babies on their backs into the fields, and there'd be hundreds of them in the fields, working the fields, and they'd spray the pesticides while the women and children and men were in the fields. He remembered he had nieces and nephews who were killed. They just never made it. Some of them died that day in the fields, the little babies. So the planes would just come over and spray these pesticides right on the people. It was a feeling that these people were of absolutely no worth and expendable. There was a move from constant terror to constant control, basically. Because of the human rights violations, Guatemala had become sort of a pariah nation. It's the worst violations in our hemisphere, and people were not trading with Guatemala. They were looking at Guatemala as a sort of as an outcast. And this was something they had to deal with, to restore their status in the international community. And part of it was the so-called the strategy of democratization of Guatemala. That is, write a new constitution, get a civilian president, say that these move away from terror and have the kind of controlled society, so that you can say we are now becoming democratized. And the United States certainly bought that hook, line, and sinker because they wanted to buy it. U.S. aid increased eightfold in 1987 over 1985 because Premier President Reagan said that our withdrawal of aid under Carter, because of the violations in Guatemala, now can end because of the return of democracy. My contention and many other contention is that there's a mask of democracy, that it is in form only, that it's that it's of no substance. I was down there, and we'll show slides in a minute of this. At an interesting time, last April, there's been a lot of talk this last year. Prefaces by saying, Vinicio Cerezo. Cerezo was elected president of Christian Democratic Party by 70% vote in a fair election, good election. And December of 1985, came into office in January of 86. There were high hopes. Part of the price he had to pay was agree there would be no land reform. He agreed that there would be no trials of the military people who were responsible for the deaths and assassinations in the past. So it became apparent that he had not much room to move. Vinicio, the military extracted from the Congress these agreements prior to the election, but they do have a civilian government. There's an interesting image, because Cerezo is a fairly popular person, and they like him in United States Congress, just love him. He's great. He had a liberal past. The pictures of him always show Cerezo, handsome and plain, and he's surrounded by four generals, and that's. He can move about 2 inches.
But was it the Congress of Guatemala that?
Yeah.
Expected?
Yeah.
So he's not head of the military there.
Like no, that. No, he cannot control the military, and that's basically the issue. The military is still in control, but they do have a civilian government. Another interesting thing is the peace plan. August 86. No, August 87 in Escapulas. I want to say a little more about that. There's a lot of talk about the peace plan, and Cerezo wants to get a lot of credit for it, even though Arias was the part of it. Cerezo thinks it was his in country, and he is playing a major role in that. Another thing, the whole issue of land reform. I mentioned last time the Catholic Church came out with a pastoral on land. Reform, which is a very progressive pastoral letter, and elicited a lot of anger from the business community, but also that Father Jerome, a Catholic priest, is leading a mass movement on land distribution. And this is, so land reform is being talked about publicly for the first time since 54. No one talked publicly, out loud, published anything about land reform. Now it's being talked about. Human rights, there's a group called GOM, which is basically Mothers of the Disappeared. A couple of years ago, they had enough courage, and amazing courage, to form a group. The first woman who was leader of the group, she and her child were killed. But others have been taken up the group. Well, they have marches. They try to find out, and they continually badger Cerezo about when are you going to have investigations. See, one of the things is in Guatemala you can get away with murder. You can actually murder someone, and there'll be no investigation. And so this means clearly those who have the weapons, those who have the strength, can eliminate those who don't. And so when you don't have a judicial system, you don't have a National Human Rights Commission, and an adequate judicial system, and you don't have an investigative system, you can have the rise, like in El Salvador and Guatemala, death squads of paramilitary people that eliminate any organizers, labor organizers, church organizers. About 12 priests have been killed, and hundreds of catechists, a number of nuns. Health workers are very dangerous, because most of the health workers found that if you're going to deal with people's health, What they really need is more food. Therefore, you start organizing for more land. They need clean water, so you're organizing. So health workers soon become organizers, and they are endangered. Then there's the emergence of popular movements. The labor movement is beginning to organize again. The students are beginning to organize again. As I mentioned before, in the early 80s, all the student leaders at San Carlos University were killed, and many of the labor leaders were killed. So they said, whenever there's an opening, and there's been openings in the past, there's an opening, you begin to have popular movements, human rights groups, labor groups, church groups are speaking out, and then after a certain part, wham. And that's why this coup was sort of an attempted coup, was a sign of that. And now the leaders of the opposition, Rigoberto Menchú being one of them, there's an international group of leaders of the opposition in exile. And from Canada to the United States and Mexico is where they live. And four of that delegation returned to Guatemala a couple of weeks ago to test out the democratic opening. And that was amazing. Well, they came just as we left, and they were escorted by someone from Dellum's office and someone from a couple of congressmen's office in the United States went down with them. Two of them were arrested right when they landed at the airport and released because of international pressure that same day. But when they went to the hotel where they were staying, about 2,000 people came out to the hotel. And they began to get massive crowds wherever they went, and which was courageous on a lot of part because they thought they'd go around and no one would come to see them because it's dangerous to become identified with these people as they returned. But they found out people did come out. And I think this further worried the younger army officers that wanted to clip that early.
Is Rigoberto Menchú restricted from going into certain areas? We've heard that.
Well, no, yes, they were. They certainly were only allowed in Guatemala City this time. But they traveled around. In fact, Cerezo then provided them with a military escort around to the places where they were to go. What he wanted to show is that his part in the peace plan, that it's safe for the exiles to return. Well, it backfired because it was safe if they had a military escort, and they were arrested for several hours, and there were bomb threats. And Mexicana Airlines that flew them in, their office in Guatemala City was bombed because they flew them in. And they got away with going back for a week and getting out. But it's not the thing you'd want to do. Let me run down the peace plan in August 7th among the five countries. It called for national reconciliation, that is, an internal dialogue, a national reconciliation commission between the opposing forces, and amnesty. Second, it called for ceasefire. Actions, military actions. Third, call for democratization, full freedom of the press and radio, assembly, and campaigning. And it also called for cutoff of aid to Contras and other insurgents, and for non-use of territory for Contra attacks, so the other countries could use their countries as bases for the Contras. It had a plan for refugees, to allow refugees to return, and a verification commission, an international verification commission. This is what all countries, now of course everybody said this whole thing, and Guatemala said, well, this was really written for Nicaragua, because we don't have a war in Guatemala. And they pretty much dismissed. And they said, General Gramajo said, this really doesn't apply to us. We have sporadic actions, but we don't have a war. The refugees are free to come back, blah, blah, blah. Well, Cerezo happened to be in Europe shortly after that, and he was asked by several places, will you meet with the United Opposition? Of course, publicly in your peace talk. He said, of course I will. So then he had to meet. He set up a meeting in Madrid, Spain in October. First time in 27 years the representatives from Guatemala met with the United Opposition. The United Opposition sent their top five leaders. Guatemala sent their ambassador to Spain because he was already there. A vice chairman of their Congress, and three military officers. It's appropriate that they sent the military because you might as well talk to them. They're the ones who really. And they met for two or three days, and they haven't met since. So they had the one meeting. It was clear. Cerezo was trying to meet and say, sure, we'll meet with the opposition, and he had to go through with it. But nothing really came of that meeting, except that the opposition, which is a united guerrilla organization, has come up with a fascinating plan, but not met. Well, the verification group that then went to Guatemala in January and tried to examine what had happened. And they interviewed a lot of people and found that National Reconciliation Commission, which was required by the peace plan, was indeed appointed, but it had never met. The meeting with the URNG, with the opposition group, did take place, but nothing was followed up. Ceasefire. There was no ceasefire in Guatemala. In fact, in November and December, there was an escalation of the war, and they tried to call it the final campaign, and tried to the Guatemala army to defeat the guerrillas in the highlands, which was they failed to do. But there's an increase in death squad activity. In terms of refugee return, a few refugees returned to Mexico, but they said they found it impossible because the refugees came back and they no longer had access to their land. Their land had already been taken. So one of their requirements is, if we come back, we want the titles to our land restored. We want the civilian patrol. We don't want not to be enforced to go into the civil patrols. And we want freedom of movement. And these are the requirements and human rights respected before we come back. And none of those are take place in Guatemala. Amnesty. Amnesty is ironic. Guatemala government says there's no need for amnesty. We have no political prisoners. And indeed, they do not. They have killed everybody that they've taken into custody. But they did give amnesty to all the military that had done all the killing. So they said, we've obeyed the amnesty thing. After the interviews, the verification committee came to the conclusion that the measures taken by the Christian Democratic Party President Benicio Cerezo were only formalities which have become obstacles to the advancement of the peace accords. The two important points were the continuation of human rights abuses and the constant denial to dialogue and to seek a ceasefire with the Guatemalan National Revolutionary Unity. So then they made their report, the international made the report, and then Cerezo talked to the other presidents, and they decided to disband the international verification groups, and that each country would be responsible for verifying their own following of the peace accords. Well, what is required in Guatemala? Clearly, and I'll conclude with this and we can talk more, a full respect of human rights, an effective court system. Some kind of plan for land distribution, somehow. That is a time bomb. They'll either have to eliminate the Indian population or come to terms with some kind of land distribution. I think they're going to have to come to terms with the explanation for the disappeared. Argentina has tried that. I think what Cerezo says, and also it was echoed when we met with the American embassy. The American ambassador said, listen, there was killing on both sides. Let's have a clean slate. This was the idea. let's not try to invest, bring up these old wounds. They obviously, the mothers of the disappeared and anybody else concerned said, you've got to investigate. In order to give amnesty, they said even, you've got to investigate and apply guilt. I mean, they could live with amnesty, I suppose, if they said yes. These people did drag away people, they killed them. But so you have to have some kind of investigation and trials. You have to dismantle the mechanisms of popular control. That is how you control a population to these various kind of camps and civil patrols. And they're talking about freedom for the popular movements, freedom of organization. And I would think essential from our point of view is a different U.S. attitude toward Central America, toward Guatemala.
You never hear about Guatemala.
Right.
Not right now, because there's no war.
We don't hear about Guatemala because I think that is part of what we call low-intensity conflict. We keep it out of visibility, and Guatemalans can keep stability their own way. If there's a massacre, if priests are killed, when, who is that priest in Poland, Popolowski? Something that was killed, and there was great fear over a priest being killed by the state.
Mm-hmm.
People are killed. I think as long as Guatemala is one of our allies, and the government's been holding up Guatemala as an example. When we met with the embassy, they had meeting with us, their economic advisor, their military advisor, their AID advisor, and the ambassador, and one other. And all of them, I was surprised, all of them except the ambassador had been in Southeast Asia. And they said, we learned from Southeast Asia and they think we will do a better job of providing what they call stability, a country that is stable and they call it democratic. And of course we have to, they said, we have to defeat the guerrillas and then support the economy. And part of their support for the economy, they said, if we could talk, this is interesting, if we could talk to the farmers, small farmers, create small farmers, and talk them into growing broccoli, because there's a real market for broccoli, and you know, the way we can preserve, and Guatemala has a good climate for broccoli, and whatever, they could market broccoli in the United States. And,
sure, so that could all be taken over.
That, yeah, so.
Who supports the military? Foreign, U.S. government?
The military, because they were on their own for so long, in power for so long, they have built some very sophisticated armaments. They build their own tanks. They build their own...
Where do they get the money?
From the U.S.
They get the money because they're a very, fairly wealthy nation. In other words, the money comes really off the back of exploited poor. So there's the export of cotton, cattle, McDonald's. Well, McDonald's claims they don't buy beef from Central America, but it's an agribusiness export economy that supports an elite population that is aligned with the military, and the United States finds that acceptable, preferable to having land distribution or anything like that. In fact, we tend to call, label as communist, all the same way the Guatemalan government labels as communist any efforts toward social change there.
Do that all the time.
Right.
Don't we send? Doesn't the U.S. send military aid to the Guatemalan government?
Now we do. We send. I'm trying to figure out. Yes, it's a certain amount of military aid we do, and that's increasing. But before we were allowed to send military aid, we sent non-military aid, but it was helicopters. And it was a lot of trucks for transporting. And it was all, it became military aid. But it was not then guns and planes. Mm. And they were making their own.
Mm. Did you read in Sojourners recently that Andrew Young, the mayor of Atlanta, recently went down to Guatemala to see about the possibility of training the police force in the U.S.?
That's an interesting issue and fascinating because we were appalled why Andrew Young would have the Atlanta Police Department involved in training the Guatemalan police. But again, this is how charming Cerezo is, and but Young, who has such a progressive civil rights policy. Well, we organized nationally a campaign on Andy Young. Basically, Young bought the liberal line that as long as Cerezo is in power, we should teach Cerezo how his police so that they can become independent of the army. Now, and he bought that as a the argument all the Guatemalans make is never give military aid until after there are internal reforms. You give aid to police now, and it'll be simply doing what we've done in the past, training the police how to continue in their abuses and more effectively. We've got our whole, the way they've computerized their investigation both in El Salvador and Guatemala is based upon U.S. training techniques. There's an interesting cartoon. It shows, I think it was Andy Young, talking in a training class of Guatemala police and saying, we want it's a gory cartoon, saying, today's class is to teach you how to take fingerprints without removing the fingers. so the humanizing the police.
It seems like our government is okay. You can do anything in the name of democracy. As long as it's not in the name of communism, it's okay.
And also, another thing, well, I don't know, I have been very behind in current events since having a baby in Costa Rica and all the work there was to do, but I know that since the peace plan, the military aid to Costa Rica, which is, Costa Rica isn't supposed to have a military, but they do have a military, and the military aid to Costa Rica was basically cut this year, and I think maybe the U.S. is trying to kind of punish Costa Rica for the peace plan. So you see these things happening because the local police group, which is basically the military unit in our area, Comandancia of the South, didn't have money for anything. I mean, they didn't have money to operate their trucks or gasoline money or anything. They had to come up with all the money, and it was because of this cut in aid. So it's interesting how the U.S. punishes and
rewards.
We use aid as a weapon. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's of course
it's
why.
It's a political weapon.
Why?
It's not an economic.
No.
Really.
No.
Not really to help the people, but whether it's politics.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the basic. The basic problem with U.S. policy always and everywhere is that it turns everything into an east-west fight. And it isn't that, and most of the time it isn't that at all.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't in South Africa, it isn't in Central America, it is not an east-west. I mean, it's nonsense about Nicaraguan troops marching up through Brownsville. It's so laughable.
Right.
And the problem is the poverty and the way in which these people, the way in which the wealth is distributed to them, really, it's a social problem.
Right.
You said something yesterday about the mass down there are not educated. And therefore today, you know, 2% of the people will control 96% of the so-called the assets. Until you educate uneducated people, all these other things we're talking about is just, you know, at least the way history is recorded, it just doesn't work. And how are you going to educate these people when the people that are control things, they kind of like it?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So what do they want to go out and you know, it'll take generations. It'll take generations to happen.
But
and my mind isn't that my mind isn't that big that I can see in my lifetime, your lifetime, even we would, that things would begin to turn around because of the so-called power down there.
But there are things we can do fairly immediately. And then another, we don't have to aid those who are preventing the education.
Well, I'll buy that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'll buy that. But this is, we make money doing that. And somebody's got the idea, you know, the United States has never done anything wrong. That's the way I learned it when I was in school. And I'll bet you too, you too did too. You know, we are it.
One nation.
Been brainwashed.
Yeah.
And I never heard that until, you know, 50 years ago. But now I've heard it and I understand it. And so we kind of like to make a profit. These banana, what do you call it, United Fruit, you mentioned. They kind of like that. And they don't pay these people to pick their bananas. Why should they? But yet we make a profit because of a corporation that is headquartered here.
We eat the bananas.
Pardon?
We eat the bananas.
Oh, gee whiz. Well, that's all right. But it goes around and around. Tell that people up here in the cafeteria, we eat bananas here, even here. And around and around and around you go, you know. And boy, what can you?
Another point is that we're the ones that have given credibility to and in some situations have created the military elites that exist or have existed in Central America.
Mm-hmm.
The National Guard of under Somoza and that was seen as the answer to the Central American problem, giving credibility to the military elites, that they would be the tool for social reform. And
yes.
I wonder why we even think that. In our own country, we would never let the military be the government. Why do we think that kind of democracy would work in any other country?
Or at least that was a smokescreen.
No, they're right. They've definitely, the U.S. Embassy states very clearly that we are trying to have the military as a part of the government. They know they can't eliminate the military. It's the military that controls the situation, which is favorable to us. But they would like the military to be a little more professional, a little more humane. I think we could still have, obviously, our bananas and our sugar. And because I'm sure the campesinos growing them would love to sell them to us. And the cooperatives developed down there would love to sell them to us. So we could still
get the money for doing it.
Right. We could still have
on the land and not.
Yeah.
Right.
And not be part of this feudal system where they don't own anything and if they.
Right.
Yeah.
But where we lived, and this I'm sure is somewhat different in Guatemala, but this feudal system was very accepted and very well liked because really they were getting paid better than they were before the feudal system. But the only thing is they lost all their power, you know, by accepting the loss of all their
land.
That's what also happened in Guatemala. When I said the land was taken away, they were almost seduced off the land because it was so hard for them to survive on the land. They built these big plantations and said, look, if you come down here work in the plantations, we will, you can survive. And so a lot of people were lured into the large plantations and it turned out to be a kind of trap for them because there's no way they can get out of that. Maybe what I might do is just take a quick look at these slides. I think the best vision of Guatemala is in this video. If anyone wants to look at that, but some may come at 11. Let's try to close a couple of these curtains. I don't think we need many. And turn the chair around some way.
Oh, this.
That's okay. That might be enough. The security guards outside restaurants and other places carry these machine guns. But I suppose that in the United States you always see security guards with pistols, but it's they're sort of scary whenever you go into an establishment or many establishments.
What are they securing?
Same thing you do in the United States when you see
people sure bringing you a bomb or something like that. Is that
no, I think it's primarily intimidating, but robberies on the rise in cities.
Supposed to be sent for security,
but yeah. You see this in Nicaragua too.
And of course, one of the McDonald's frequently in Guatemala City. This is the police training center in the city. They instructed us not to take pictures at all of military police while we were there. They said we might incur it. Rios Montt used to be president of the country. He is sort of an elder in this evangelical church. Probably the fastest growing congregations are the right-wing evangelical congregations. And that's his church. This is downtown Guatemala City. Again, the influence of North American stores, Rockport or Wrangler.
How big a city is Guatemala City?
About 2 million.
I look at that. That's downtown. That wide, huh?
Yeah.
2 million people.
They're similar to those, quite a few of those streets. But this is now what we're going to see. The woman on the left is Mary Noel's sister, who was living on the edge of town in the shanty towns. And this is where, see, about 1 million refugees in Guatemala during the violence. Some of them went to Mexico, some went to the United States, some went up to the mountains. A lot of them went to Guatemala City, and they grabbed pieces of wood wherever they could and slowly built these shanty towns. They have no electricity, no running water, no sewage. They're sort of built on the edge of dumps. And they call it land invasions. People just took over the land and built up. So Guatemala City went from 1.2 million to about 2 million people, and largely on the outskirts of town are these kind of centers.
And they came from the areas that had the valuable land?
Yeah, these are mostly indigenous people that came from the highlands and where there was bombing. And so that the military could drive the guerrillas, the opposition, out of the mountains and the highlands and also reclaim some of the land for themselves. This was a kind of primitive health center in that trying to show basic sanitation. A water truck would come in and you could get your barrel of water, which you use for washing, for drinking. Each house would have their own barrel of water.
Come every day?
You could buy You'd have to buy it. And you'd take a quetzal, which would probably be 40 cents, and they'd fill up your water truck, your water. And that was the way of, and there's a little girl washing her doll clothes. And we met then with some of the women who saw us there and gathered around. And Gloriana, who was the married old sister, has begun to get these women talking together. About 20% of the men are employed. Some of the men go into Guatemala City in the morning and try to hustle some money or sell some things they get. But the women are here raising children and trying to get firewood. And so anything like getting firewood to get some cooking done is a real chore. It takes about an hour a day. Negotiating so they can find some money to get some water, maybe making some clothes. See, when they come into Guatemala City, none of them wear their indigenous clothing anymore. They're trying to get the women to begin to develop a collective and work together and meet together and do Bible study together. And this little girl had a rabbit. So some of them were raising rabbits. And so there's a lot of children in these areas. We spent some time in Chimaltenango and met with the elders of Presbyterian Church there. These are the elders of the church. It was interesting. We asked each of them to tell their story, and all of them, I mean, the man with the red sash had lost his wife and children in the massacre. Another man would lost the children. So all of them had some left the mountains and came down to Chimaltenango, which is the city. But they were introducing themselves, and they said, well, I'm an elder in the church, and I'm a Roman Catholic. And someone said, I'm in charge of evangelism for the Presbyterian Church, and I'm a Roman Catholic. And they all identified themselves as part of Catholic Action or that, but they were the leaders of the Presbyterian Church. And they said, to them, that was just natural that they'd... And I think it was because forming a base community in the Catholic Church was a fairly dangerous thing, but being part of a Presbyterian Church was not at all dangerous. So, and this was the man I stayed, the family I stayed with, that was the house I stayed in for a couple of nights. And they were able to build a cinder block house, but it was just that, and that was the kitchen out of the back of the house. And Veronica was her name, and she cooked the meal for us on this outside kitchen. And these were the two of the children. And Felipe Ishkot was her father. The five of them lived in that cinder block square without any windows, just the door. And they had two beds, and they gave a friend and I one bed, and the five of them took the other bed. But that was very important. This and two others of our group met with this family, which was also a member of the church. And another group met with this family. So we all stayed with different families that were part of the church. And I think that's probably the most important part of the trip, not meeting with the labor unions as important as the ambassadors, but spending some time living with on the dirt floor and with a family. And then we went to an orphanage. There's 100,000 orphans. It seems like a nation of orphans in Guatemala, some neighboring country. And these are just children of people, parents who've been killed. And a Catholic group had a very outstanding orphanage. I was impressed with how they set it up. They taught them their own language, in fact. Rather than teaching them Spanish, they taught them Kakichel. And so that as adults, if they grew up, they could go back to their villages. The trouble with orphanages, sometimes they come down to orphanages in Guatemala City, and then they go back to their villages, and they can't talk to their people anymore. Something about Guatemala that is not unlike mountains in North America. These are the smallish farms in the highlands. They farm, as you can see, the hillsides, any piece of land they can get, and of course down in the valleys. It's 8,000 feet up there, so it's cool, much like Holden. This is in Quetzaltenango, the second largest city in Guatemala. primarily an Indian, an indigenous town. And people there, of course, most people wear their indigenous costumes. Then we went down to the lowlands, which were the large, this is a sugar factory, and very hot, and the large plantations in the lowlands. We went to see Padre Giron, he wasn't there, his associate, Mr. Ovalle, told us about the peasant movement that Father Giron is leading. And we went to Padre Giron's church, and then back up to Guatemala City, where Father Giron was on a hunger strike, a fast, rather, for 4 days, demanding more land. And he would not, and this is in front of the National Palace, and about 200 campesinos slept right on the, right in front of the palace with Father Giron. And after 4 days, he had Cerezo, he met with Cerezo and got an agreement to be able to buy two more plantations. He was in exile in the United States and learned and spoke English, but is a very courageous man. This is the Catholic Church on the other corner from the cathedral, and we met with Efren Hernandez, the assistant to the bishop, the archbishop, and talked with him about not only the pastoral letter on land, but the Human Rights Commission. We met with some labor unions, and this was the largest, the most progressive, rather, of the unions. They didn't want us to take their pictures, but they said we could take pictures of their posters on their walls. But the Coca-Cola union was glad to have us talk with them. The Coca-Cola union went through a famous, now a day and a half, a year and a half strike, which was a lockout. And they were very glad to talk to us about this, about their efforts. And it's probably the strongest union in Guatemala. They have in the cafeteria, the labor union cafeteria, 8 pictures, this is 4 of them, of the martyrs that have been killed on these, in the early 80s, and these were Coca-Cola organizers. So it's...
What kind of organizers were they?
They were labor organizers, the Coca-Cola union.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and this is the Grupo de GAM, or the Apoyo Mutuo, the mutual support group. Again, they didn't want us to take their pictures, but I just... this is the only human rights organization that is outspoken now in Guatemala. And again, sort of before we left the Center for Crafts, I just want to, this is in front of the U.S. Embassy. This was the only time we were searched. But whenever you go to U.S. Embassy, it's always, you know, you got to leave your tape recorders and everything else. And in fact, I left my tape recorder and my camera, and when I came back, the tape was rewound. But fortunately, the other people on the tape that I'm talking to, like Gom and others, were, because they wanted to find out where we've been. I should have known to pop my tape out rather than leave it in the tape recorder in their hands.